Hi, everybody. This is Adriana Trigiani. I'm the host of You Are What You Read. I have the privilege of interviewing luminaries of our times about the books that shaped them from childhood until now. We get everybody from Sarah Jessica Parker to Kristen Hanna, Mitch Albom, Susie Essman, Craig Ferguson, Rainn Wilson, Amor Towles, you name it, they come, they share. New episodes of You Are What You Read drop every Tuesday on Apple, Spotify, or any major streaming platform wherever you listen to your podcasts.
The Joyce Kaufman Podcast is being brought to you by Code Red Roofers, South Florida's leading residential and commercial roof experts. Code Red Roofers, roofers that respond. Call 844-4-CODE-RED or visit coderedroofers.com.
On this week's No Restraint Podcast, I have just returned from a fantastic vacation in Puerto Rico, which of course is my heritage. I went with my grandsons and their parents. I guess that would be my children, but it's all about the grandsons. And while I was there, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard struck Israel. And I thought it would be interesting to see how people in Puerto Rico thought about it. But much to my chagrin and surprise, they didn't really know much about it, and they didn't seem to care very much about it. So if you're a Jewrican, which is my heritage as well, it was kind of disturbing at the very least. I saw an article by Maddie Friedman in Free Press, which really talked about how now there's no denying what the real war in the Middle East is. You see, our politicians want to keep telling us that these poor, beleaguered Palestinians have been deprived of their natural land and their right to have a sovereign country, even though they have no language, they have no currency, and they really have no right to any of the land there. Not even a historical or a religious right, but hey, I don't want to confuse you with facts. So I don't think we can any longer deny that the real war that's taking place in the Middle East is actually a war with Iran. It's not with Israel at all. The night of tension and aerial booms that they heard in Jerusalem on Saturday and Sunday, including many families that were in their safe rooms as the air raid sirens were blaring in the streets and the Iron Dome was zap, zap, zapping, working overhead, the direct consequences of an Iranian attack from Iran, not from the proxy, on Israel haven't really come into focus yet. But it's like a flash that goes off in a darkened room. The attack has finally given the world something very important, something super valuable that they've been trying to ignore. And that's a glimpse of the real war in the Middle East. Because for the past 6 months, since the Hamas massacre of October 7th, there has been a lot of ideological forces that have come out against Israel, in spite of the fact that Israel did their best to make it seem like it was a war in which there were two sides, and that these sides are Israeli soldiers and the other side are Palestinian civilians. But that's not true. And that information campaign is critical to Israel's enemies. It's actually more critical to them than the actual physical war, because it erodes the Western support that Israel has to have to survive. And certainly, if they plan on winning, they have to first survive. The successful execution ending Hamas has turned into a jihadi war against the Jewish minority enclave in the Middle East. It's a story which they now want you to believe is Jewish oppression and even genocide of Palestinians, a story that has become the focus of the increasingly deranged discourse in the liberal West, especially on college campuses. Israel's ideological antagonists these days aren't only Hamas and Iran, but now they're the entire Western press, the entire Western academia, and now the entire NGO, non-governmental organizations world, that's providing a lot of the fodder for the storytelling that the West is going on with. This is the main reason that so many observers struggle to understand what's going on, including my family in Puerto Rico. In all the previous rounds of fighting in Gaza, the Hamas tactic of hiding fighters and weapons behind civilians and of feeding false casualty numbers and selective photographs and images to a credulous press generated an overpowering impression of needless civilian tragedy and, therefore, a a lot of outrage designed to tie Israel's hands, as well as just continue generating animosity towards Jews all over the world. This largely fictional narrative is a continuation of many years of press coverage, insisting that the story here is an Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which of course sets up the region's 6 million Jews as some sort of powerful majority, and the region's hundreds of millions of Arabs and Muslims, the vast majority of whom are not Palestinian, as some sort of beleaguered minority. That just begs any understanding on my part. The truth is there isn't an Israeli-Palestinian conflict that exists in isolation. There's an Arab-Muslim war with Jews, and it's about a century old, in which most of the combatants on the Arab side have not been Palestinian, and some of the Jewish victims haven't been Israeli, like the Argentinians that were killed by Iranian terrorists at a Jewish community center in 1994, for example, or the masses of Jews that were forced from their homes in the Islamic world after Israel was actually founded. These days, the relevant conflict is between the alliance led by the Shia clerics of Iran's Islamic Republic against states in the American orbit, most of them Sunni, like Jordan and Saudi Arabia, and just one of them Jewish. And now it should be perfectly clear for anybody who still has any doubts that Gaza is just one part of a broader story of Iran's growing power and its tightening encirclement of Israel. When you understand it in that context, the behavior of Israel and its opponents become easier to understand. Hamas and Islamic Jihad in Gaza are one link in the Iranian encirclement. The Houthis in Yemen, who've been harassing commercial ships and firing at Israel's southern port of Eilat, are another link. The Iranian-backed militias in Iraq make up a third. The Iranian forces and proxies in Syria, including the Revolutionary Guard commanders that were killed in that recent Israeli airstrike in Damascus, are a fourth. The strike on April 1st, which came after months of attacks against Israel by proxies directed and armed by the Revolutionary Guards, is typically being cast by Israel's opponents as an unprovoked attack on a diplomatic facility, as if the commanders were cultural attachés in town for a goodwill concert. Lebanon's Hezbollah, whose bombardments have depopulated a whole swath of northern Israel since October 7th, is the fifth. If you look at a map, you'll see that Iran has methodically installed proxies that can strike Israel from almost any direction except the west, because there they border the Mediterranean Sea. The importance of the barrage that just came down of drones and cruise missiles was that for the first time, the full Iranian alliance gave a practical demonstration of its scope, the orchestration involved, and more importantly, their intentions. The radical departure here was that the Islamic Republic itself dared to attack directly for the very first time. If you were watching this from space, you probably could have seen the lines of the new Middle East etched in orange and red across the map of the region. You might have also seen the second part of the story, which is the successful defense that was mounted not just by Israel, but by the U.S. and Britain, and also by Jordan and apparently Saudi Arabia. A welcome development, hard to imagine just a few years ago, and still puzzling to a Western observer who gets stories fed to them about an Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Now, whether this attack was a masterstroke or a mistake by Iran will eventually become clear. But it's already obvious that they've done observers a favor by emerging from the shadows to end any doubt about what this war is and who's fighting it. After 3 decades of shadow war and 13 days of foreshadowing, Iran launched a first-ever direct attack on Israel early on Sunday morning. The attack, which comes after Israel's airstrike on the Iranian embassy compound in Damascus, was unprecedented for its scale. There were 350 projectiles. Its target, Israel, directly. And the source, Iran, directly. Iran also used different weapons, drones and cruise missiles, ballistic missiles, with different speeds, 9 hours, 2 hours, 12 minutes to target, from different sites, mostly Iran, but also proxies in Yemen, Iraq, and Syria. The presumed aim was for them all to reach Israel en masse and overwhelm Israel's air defenses. But most of the projectiles were still downed before even reaching Israel.
All these crazy alien stories can't be true, can they? Hey, it's Stephen Diener, host of the Unidentified Alien Podcast. And whether you're new to the conversation or have been looking into it for years, you need to check out the fastest growing alien show out there, the Unidentified Alien Podcast, or UAP for short. There's a crazy amount of alien encounter stories out there from all over the world. And the beauty of it is that I bring them all to you and let you decide what you believe. Download and subscribe to UAP on any of the major podcasting platforms. And you can also find it on UAPpodcast.com.
Israel's borders, thanks to the support from allies like the U.S., the U.K., and France, thanks to Iran's own technical failings, half of its 110 ballistic missiles failed, and intervention from neighbors like Jordan. A statement to placate domestic anti-Israel sentiment said Jordan only shot down drones in its airspace as self-defense rather than for the benefit of Israel. But that is bullpucky. Israel's layered air defenses then handled most of the rest, with the 16 minutes of action reportedly costing Israel an estimated $1 billion. Seven of Iran's 110 ballistic missiles still made it, though, causing some minor damage at Nevatim Air Base, which is the main home for Israel's F-35 fighter jets, which Iran blames for the attack in Damascus. And throughout it all, Iran's behavior was interesting to watch. 72 hours before the launch, it started telegraphing its plans. And then, with drones in the air, its UN mission tweeted that the matter can be deemed concluded. No backseas. And after impact, Iran's president and others went on to warn Israel to just leave it or face more attacks. Why? Iran was likely looking for that elusive sweet spot in its shifting Venn diagram of A, satisfying its own domestic pressure to respond to Israel, B, maintaining credibility in the broader region, and yet probably also C, assuming few projectiles would actually hit Israel, narrowing Israel's justification to hit back. And the world's responses have been intriguing, mostly mixing condemnation of Iran with an urging of Israel not to escalate things further. U.S. officials are also describing the events as a major victory for Israel, likely seeking to give Netanyahu political space to just take the win. But Israel's leaders are seeing it differently, with key hardliners in Netanyahu's threadbare coalition saying Israel must respond with a crushing attack that resonates for generations. So Netanyahu is again facing pressure abroad to show restraint while facing pressure at home to go hard. And that presents Netanyahu with his own shifting Venn diagram, seeking to A, respond to domestic pressures, B, maintain regional credibility, and C, retain international solidarity without just D, bolstering the regime's support in Iran. So this whole situation now looks like one giant Rubik's Cube of leverage, escalation, deterrence, and destabilization. But have a think about who wins. Israel has now flexed two of its sources of power, air defense and alliances, and seen two of its vulnerabilities moved off the front pages, political instability and the humanitarian toll in Gaza, watching them both be replaced with a vivid global illustration of the very thing Israel has been warning about for decades, Iranian missiles over Israel. Meanwhile, Iran claims it's now shown its resolve and flexed its ability to penetrate Israel's air defenses and perfectly calibrated it all, maximum symbolism, minimum damage, to avoid escalation. But ultimately, rather than deter Israel, Iran essentially gave it a much-needed moment of international solidarity. That's an Israeli win. And yet Israel's leaders, fueled by the historic sight of Iranian missiles over Jerusalem, will struggle to pocket that solidarity and heed the world's calls for restraint. That turns up the heat for the region, where everyone keeps saying they don't want a wider war, and yet everyone keeps crisscrossing the map with red lines, each intended to end the cycle, but all collectively raising the risk of accelerating it. Shortly before launching its attack, Iran also seized a Portuguese-flagged cargo ship carrier in the Strait of Hormuz, claiming it was Israeli-owned. 20 sailors from the Philippines were on board. Shrapnel from Iran's attack on Israel critically injured a 10-year-old Arab-Israeli Bedouin girl in the Negev Desert. Hours after Iran's attack, Hamas reportedly rejected the latest ceasefire proposal from mediators. Following the weekend's attacks, the U.S. House Speaker now says he'll try again to bring a stalled U.S. military aid package to a vote, including support for Israel, plus potentially Ukraine and U.S. allies in Asia. So that's my take on what's actually happening in the Middle East right now. But I also wanted to talk about how the young and the old are fleeing the demented Democrats. President Biden has made the student loan forgiveness like a top priority after young voters elected him by pretty large margins back in 2020. Ahead of another matchup with former President Donald Trump, their concerns are that the voting bloc might just abandon him anyway. Despite Joe Biden's continued efforts to cancel massive amounts of student loans for millions of Americans, along with various other left-wing policy achievements, polling indicates his lead among young voters has dropped significantly since the last cycle. The loss in support is partially attributable to Biden's support of Israel following the October 7th Hamas terrorist attack, as young individuals largely expressed support for Palestinians in Gaza. But several Democratic pollsters and strategists are saying he's doing all the right things that you would think that young voters would flock to, but unfortunately, they haven't been able to put that message out there successfully in the community. A Democratic strategist in Michigan said, "When you've done eight things, but this ninth thing is unforgiven, and you put your arm around this warmonger in Israel, and then, you know, you can't unwrap yourself from him." A completely unbiased opinion, wouldn't you say? Well, at least he identifies himself as a Democrat pollster. But Biden has already forgiven billions of dollars worth of student loans for more than 3.5 million Americans, according to the White House. The Supreme Court struck down Biden's program to grant student loan forgiveness to roughly 40 million Americans using executive power in June of 2023. Since then, the president has explored all these other avenues to achieve this policy goal, and he announced on February 21st that his administration would be canceling a $1.2 billion worth of student debt for thousands of individuals. Still, the polling indicates that he's on a track to have much less support from youth voters in November, the ones that backed him by large margins in 2020. Trump was 1 point ahead of Biden, with registered voters under 45 in an NPR PBS Marist survey that was published last Wednesday. An Emerson College poll of registered voters released the next day found Biden leading Trump among those aged 18 to 29 by only 10 points. Last cycle, Biden beat Trump among 18 to 29-year-olds by 24 points, as well as by 6 points with those aged 30 to 44. That was according to Edison Research. A Democratic pollster and redistricting consultant focused on working class racial minorities, who was speaking anonymously, I love when they do that, said that the threat Biden faces in 2024 is wealthy college students and young voters flocking from the president, really all of Biden's term, but these last 7 to 8 months, watching how Biden went to war with his own party, went to war with his own donor class, Biden, who went to war with Republicans, fought at the Supreme Court and lost, and still used bureaucratic trickery to cancel a tremendous amount of student debt for a tremendous amount of people, right? Massive, massive policy giveaway to a group of people really struggling, said the pollster. Watching all these people threaten to abstain over disagreements with Gaza and Israel's support has really forced people to question a lot of what they thought about the politics of delivery. A New York Times survey released in mid-December found Trump leading Biden by 6 points among registered voters aged 18 to 29, a group that overwhelmingly disapproved of Biden's handling of the war in Gaza at about 72%. The voting bloc was also far more critical of Israel's actions in Gaza than older voters were. These people can actually tank an election, and they have no problems with it because their lives won't be affected. Kalinda Lake, a Democratic pollster for Biden's 2020 campaign, is concerned that young individuals will either not vote or will support a third-party candidate rather than them casting a ballot for Trump. I think abortion will bring back some of the younger women in particular. I think the threat to democracy will bring back some of the younger men. I think being more aware of what's being done on student loans and on renewable energy and clean energy would help also. But I don't think we're going to have the kind of support among young people that they had in 2020. And so that means they got to make up that vote someplace else. A coalition of left-wing groups that seek to turn out young voters wrote a letter to Biden warning of such electoral repercussions due to his stance on the war in Gaza. And according to organizations including March for Our Lives, United We Dream, Gen Z for Change, and the Sunrise Movement, we are experts in youth voting behavior who have worked tirelessly across the years to generate Generation Z and millennial enthusiasm for civic action under a variety of circumstances, the group wrote. We write to issue a very stark and unmistakable warning. You and your administration's stance on Gaza risks millions of young voters staying home or voting third party next year. Biden has faced various protest votes over his handling of the war in states like Michigan, Minnesota, and Washington. Most recently, pro-Palestinian advocates encouraged Democratic primary voters to support the unrestricted option in the battleground states of Wisconsin on Tuesday, which received over 48,000 ballots. We're seeing in Michigan and Minnesota that this voting, uninstructed or uncommitted, has been working. And opinions in D.C. have been somewhat changing. Jamila Arabiat, president of the Students for Justice in Palestine at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, told NBC News ahead of the primary. Polling in battleground states like Wisconsin, Georgia, Michigan, North Carolina, Arizona, and Nevada also suggests that Biden's numbers among young people are lagging. Scott Jennings, a Republican strategist and veteran of numerous campaigns, said that he also believes the president's age and the economy are reasons why young voters are fleeing. Biden's super old and stuff is expensive. And like, you know, these are young, very young people looking at Joe Biden thinking, I have nothing in common with this person whatsoever. And also, they're living the same life that the rest of us are living every time they walk into a grocery store or go out to a restaurant. It's extraordinarily close. And so if 10,000 20-year-olds sat out the race in Wisconsin or Georgia or Nevada or anywhere else, I mean, you can see what a big problem that would be for him. And then there's the old people. Medicare, the huge government health program that serves 66 million seniors and disabled citizens, well, they're at a crossroads. And with huge demographic and fiscal challenges straight ahead, there are two dominant approaches at hand. One focuses on improving and modernizing the program by building on the best features of Medicare's popular system of competing private health plans, harnessing the benefits of personal choices and market competition. The other focuses on building up the powerful Medicare bureaucracy and doubling down on its complex system of central planning and price controls. The Medicare trustees reported last year that the trends in Medicare administrative payments and price controls governing both hospitals and physician payment already threatens seniors' future access to quality care. With the enactment of President Joe Biden's absurdly named Inflation Reduction Act, supplanting private market negotiation with government price fixing, Americans can expect a slowing of investment in research and development, and consequently a reduction in the number of new medications and breakthrough drugs, especially cancer drugs. The only debate between analysts of the CBO and private sector economists is the severity of the coming shortfalls. The House Republican Study Committee clearly gets it and grasps the urgency of this moment. The proof is its fiscal 2025 budget proposal, Fiscal Sanity to Save America. The committee's budget proposal is a refreshing exception to the prevailing Beltway wisdom. Its prescriptions align with what seniors have well demonstrated what they know and like, namely the advantages of personally chosen and more flexible benefit options that can be delivered through a more intense market competition. In substance, the Republican Study Committee proposal would build on the success of choice and competition that characterizes Medicare Advantage. Today, an estimated 52% of all Medicare beneficiaries are enrolled in Medicare Advantage, the robust system of competing private health beneficiary plans that is an alternative to traditional Medicare. Enrollment in these private health plans is growing a lot faster than it was ever predicted. For example, as recently as 2022, the Medicare trustees estimated that private plan enrollment would not top 52% until 2030. Under the budget proposal, traditional Medicare, also known as the Fed plan, would be retained as an option for Medicare beneficiaries. However, it would be improved by consolidating parts A, B, and D, like most Medicare Advantage plans, into one comprehensive benefits package. The Fed plan would compete directly on a level playing field with today's Medicare Advantage plans for senior enrollment. So as you can see, this is an issue that seniors are dealing with and thinking about all the time, and it's not breaking in the Democrats' direction at all. And there are things we need to be conscious about going into any election. Things change so rapidly that what I am so confident in talking about today may look different tomorrow. Cutting Medicare in any year is a politically perilous task. Doing so in a presidential election year by an historically unpopular president displays a trust in the tribal narratives designed to override voter intelligence. Partisans evidently think voters will never believe that President Joe Biden would dare cut Medicare. However, to the shock of many, rates were cut in the popular Medicare Advantage program as the Biden administration finalized its latest budget. During the 2012 campaign season, a man who looked a lot like then Representative Paul Ryan was featured in a TV ad wheeling an elderly woman through a park as America the Beautiful played over the sound of chirping birds. Ryan, who was the VP candidate for the Republicans in 2012, then dumped poor grandma out of her wheelchair and over a cliff as viewers were directed to call their representatives and tell them to leave Medicare alone to keep America beautiful. The Romney-Ryan ticket was ridiculed by the mainstream media for Ryan's nerdy attempts to begin the long overdue discussion about entitlement reform. Of course, his polite analysis was met with relentless ads claiming that Republicans want to gut your Medicare and Social Security. So if the Democrats lose young voters and if the Democrats lose senior voters, the Democrats are going to go all out for every other minority group. Thank you for listening to this No Restraint podcast. Share it with a friend. And of course, tune in for the next one. May God bless you. May God bless the United States of America. May God bless Israel.
The Joyce Kaufman Podcast has been brought to you by Code Red Roofers, South Florida's leading residential and commercial roof experts. Code Red Roofers, roofers that respond. Call 844-4-CODE-RED or visit CodeRedRoofers.com.